Hey, everyone. My new book, Beautiful Writers, A Journey of Big Dreams and Messy Manuscripts with Tricks of the Trade from Best-Selling Authors, is ready for pre-order. Those authors are the legends you hear here on this very show. Beautiful Writers pubs on August 23rd, and if you purchase the book now and plug in your order number over on bookmama.com, you will receive lots of really cool writerly pre-order bonuses to help you birth your own book baby. I even send you personalized book plates to include in your books for holiday gifts with 5 or more orders. I mean, how much easier is that than trying to re-gift used candles? I love win-wins. And now for the show.
It's an interesting journey that you take with writers, because I think at the beginning there is this kind of excitement, and then it's really, really hard work.
It's arduous.
It's the hardest work in some ways, because if you're going to write something that's true, you know, write something that's real, write something that's going to actually help people, you have to dig so deep, and you think you've gone deep enough, and then you have to go that extra layer deeper. It's hard. And you do have these moments when you're like, I don't know, is this going to happen? Am I going to make it? I think every writer goes through that. So in part, even when I'm making a deal with a writer,
yeah,
I know that we're going to go through a dark moment together at some point. Moments of doubt and moments of difficulty and moments when you have to think, I know my story. And then it turns out you don't know your story, that your story is maybe something deeper and maybe even more painful. And the story you've been telling yourself is your story. It takes so much bravery, which is why I have so much admiration for the writers to really do that work, because It's a gift to give to readers and to the world. And it takes something really courageous in the writer to extract that gift.
The future is dark. On this New Year's Eve, this watch night, I close my eyes and I see the darkness of my grandfather's cell. And I can feel the spirit of ever-rising optimism in the Sikh tradition, Chardikala, within him. And so the mother in me asks, what if? What if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if our America... What if our America is not dead, but a country that is waiting to be born? What if the story of America is one long labor? What if all of our grandfathers and grandmothers are standing behind us now, those who survived occupation and genocide, slavery and Jim Crow, detentions and political assault? What if they're whispering in our ear today, tonight, you are brave? What if this is our nation's great transition? What does the midwife tell us to do? Breathe. And then? Because if we don't push, we will die. If we don't push, our nation will die. Tonight, we will breathe. Tomorrow, we will labor in love, through love. And your revolutionary love is the magic we will show our children. Vaiguru Ji Ka Khalsa, Vaiguru Ji Ki Fateh. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Valerie. That's a tough act to follow.
The voice you just heard is of civil rights activist, lawyer, filmmaker, author, Valerie Kaur. And what resonates for me as her I Have a Dream speech, it was 2016, not long after the election, and Valerie was asked to speak at the Watch Night service at the Metropolitan AME Church in Washington, at a time when hate crimes against her people of Sikh faith were at their highest point since 9/11. The video has been downloaded 40 million times, and catapulted Valerie into the spotlight, where Chris Jackson, the voice you heard at the top of the show, was as spellbound as the rest of us. Chris is kind of a big deal in publishing, with his own imprint at Penguin Random House called One World. Perhaps you've heard of a few of his authors and books. Some of my faves include Trevor Noah's Born a Crime, Jay-Z's Decoded, Ta-Nehisi Coates's Between the World and Me, and Water Dancer, a recent Oprah Book Club pick. Chris and Valerie are here today to discuss her masterpiece. Well, their masterpiece, See No Stranger, a memoir and manifesto of revolutionary love. I cannot wait for you to hear how this baby, with Chris's support, was birthed. I love bringing on people who love each other, literary soulmates. That was the case a few years ago when bestselling author Dani Shapiro and her longtime agent, Jennifer Rudolph Walsh, came on the show. I can't tell you how many people told me how that episode reframed for them the agent-author relationship. It's so easy for us writers to be intimidated by the process of finding our people, and I wanted to inject a little love into the topic. So it seemed only natural we go to the next step and interview a top publisher and his author, and to hear straight from their mouths what that dream alliance looks and feels like as they work to change the world together. Love is the foundation of everything Valerie does, even when she's in the role of formidable fighter. The results of her activism and filmmaking and lawyering include winning policy change on the multiple fronts of hate crimes, racial profiling, immigration detention, solitary confinement, internet freedom, and more. She now leads the Revolutionary Love Project, whose aim is to reclaim love as a force for justice in America. I am so glad you're here. I took some time off to write and breathe myself over the past 2 months, and it's great to be back. Now, as Valerie says, it's time to push. Welcome.
Your podcast is so beautiful. I'm just so happy I was able to discover it through you inviting me to be part of it, because I was like, your conversation with Joy Harjo, and who you quoted in my book.
I know.
And it was so stunning. And it was like, that's all I want to do, is I want to listen to other beautiful writers. So on the onset, thank you so much for creating this sacred space for all of us.
Oh my gosh, that makes me so happy. I think Chris is with us.
I am. Hello.
Hi, Chris.
Hey.
Oh, your voice sounds so good. You sound like you're right here. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Okay, magic. Oh, you too. I can't even. Well, I'm going to breathe. Okay, breathe, and then we'll push. Valerie, talk to me. Every artist needs a champion or a village of champions. And you had been writing this book, See No Stranger, for over 15 years, I think, when you met Chris Jackson. Can you take us into your world when he stepped inside of it? And did that feel like a miracle?
Yes. I had started writing the stories that became See No Stranger when I was 20 years old. It was shortly after September 11th. And when my community was just at the forefront of so much hate, I was seeing things and feeling things that I wasn't seeing represented in the world around me. So I took my first book writing class as a college senior in January of 2002. And I began writing the stories that now end up in chapter 2 of this book. So really, for the last now 18 years, every year I was living the stories and writing the stories, living the stories and writing the stories, just living them and writing them and not knowing what it all added up to until this president took power in 2016. And I had this existential crisis, because at that point I'd have been a civil rights activist for my entire adult life, but now I was a new mother. And I thought, what was it all for, you know, if not to make the nation safer for my son? And so I began going back to all my stories. And I wrote this book proposal between the election and the inauguration as an act of survival. I began to see patterns in all those stories, and I began to call them the call of revolutionary love. And I remember the first time meeting Chris, it was shortly after the inauguration. You know, I had spent days at the airports with the protests against the Muslim ban and
in crisis response mode in the trenches, just weeping and organizing. And suddenly my amazing agent, Margaret, said, "We have publishers interested in your proposal." And I was swept up into WME's building. I remember being on like a top floor and I was suddenly in a different world. All day I was meeting publishers who were sitting across from me telling me what was stunning and timely about my book proposal. Because at that point, I've been an activist for so long and suddenly millions of people were wanting to know, well, how do we breathe? How do we push? How do we grow when the labor is endless and I had something to offer? And I remember I nodded politely and it was so lovely to hear and meet everybody. And then I kept thinking the entire day, I was the only person of color in the room on both sides of the couch, on both sides of the table.
Wow.
Until Chris Jackson walked in with his co-editor. And I remember being so nervous, Chris, because I had read Ta-Nehisi, I had read the authors you had published, and their works had already changed my life. So I thought, if I can just take this 45 minutes to tell Chris Jackson that I'm grateful for the impact that he has had on my life, that would be enough. Oh, and then wow. You proceeded to sit down and tell me that you saw revolutionary love as a cultural intervention. And then you went on. And I remember it was hard to focus because I had to suck my cheeks in. I was like, smiling so much. I was like, don't ruin it.
Oh my God.
It was amazing. And it wasn't just a miracle. Chris taking up my book and taking me on, it literally saved my life. Because it was the first time, just that book advance, that I had the chance to step away from crisis response mode after so many years and take a deep breath. Like, I was not going to last. And so I feel like I was given a gift that very few activists who are mothers are ever given: time off and room of my own. And I took my family to the rainforest for a year and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. And I not only began writing this book, but I really began to like put breath in my body for the first time so that I could last.
Oh my God. And didn't you bring something like 100 pounds of journals into the rainforest?
I did. I know. I had been keeping a journal since the age of 7, and I didn't know this was unusual until I started telling people, like, wait, you've kept a journal every year since you were 7 years old. And my mother, I remember, unpacked the journals, and my father and my husband pulled up a writing desk to this mountaintop. I mean, we were really in a very remote corner of the rainforest in Central America. And I began reading my entire life, like the last 30 years.
Whoa.
And it was
what a gift.
Such an experience. Yeah, it was almost like reading my life as text and seeing things I'd never seen before and culling out wisdom that I didn't know I was living at the time. And so, yes, it was a gift on so many levels.
Okay, I have about 1,000 questions, but before I get to them, I want to... Okay, so Chris,
yes.
Put me in your body. You walk into that room and you see Valerie, and you've already been reading her proposal. You're already at some point, I'm imagining, sold. But how did you experience that?
It was interesting because I had read the proposal and I had looked at some of Valerie's videos that were online. And so I got a sense of how she is as a speaker. And like Valerie talks about, we were in this particular moment when I think a lot of us were looking for ways to understand how we were going to get through this period that we were in.
Yeah.
And it was obviously sort of devastating for a lot of us when Trump was elected. But it wasn't the election so much as it was trying to think about what does this say about the country and how are we going to endure this day after day after day. And we'd already started to see the manifestations of what this administration was going to mean for people, particularly vulnerable people, particularly people of color. And we have all these different sort of metaphors that we use when we talk about movement, when we talk about creating change. And the thing that was so special about Valerie, I mean, it's hard to really describe the just fascinating combination of things that she brings when she's, you know, in your presence personally, and or on Zoom, which was mostly how we interacted over the course of working on this book. But there is a kind of quiet in Valerie, and then there's this enormous power.
Yeah.
And so I was already very affected by the proposal, affected by the idea of thinking about change in a different way through a different sort of metaphorical language, the language of breathing and pushing, language of birth, but also coming through this really interesting combination of sort of historical antecedents, where she was incorporating elements from the American Civil Rights Movement and from Black feminism and from Sikh practices, that there was this incredible, powerful synthesis at a moment when it felt like we needed synthesis of every kind of force that wasn't the force that we were opposing. But in addition to that, she had this way of incorporating even the force that we were opposing into our path forward. Yeah. And I thought that was what it's what I needed. And Valerie was such a powerful vessel for that message. And then being in the room with her after having watched the video and read the proposal, and she does have this kind of, you know, this other part of her, which has a kind of quiet sort of intensity, was, it felt like something special was happening just in that kind of interaction in an office building with four of us in the room. And I felt like, you know, when I sign up writers, I think of them all as being like, I'm assembling this team of superheroes, right? And each one of them has some kind of special superpower that they're going to bring to this process that we have in front of us of changing this country. And I felt like Valerie was definitely part of that team. You know, from the time I met her, I felt like she had such a special contribution to that larger project that I think all of the writers that I try to work with are engaged in, and but was really a unique and powerful voice in what I hope to be a larger shift in our consciousness. So I knew immediately that I wanted to work with her.
Chris, I wish that you could see my computer right now, because I had written in my notes, Chris, you are known for finding and developing and publishing some of our most visionary storytellers. It is your superpower. And guess what? I erased that. But it is your superpower. I erased it because I was like, Linda, oh, come on. You sound so lame. Like,
I'll do it for you. Don't worry.
Okay, but my God. Okay, so you were there from the beginning when Ta-Nehisi Coates envisioned and wrote his first books. For anyone who listening who hasn't followed Ta-Nehisi's career, I've read and listened to Between the World and Me over and over because it's probably one of the most beautiful things ever written in the history of this planet. And you were there. You were there. And, you know, it's not just me saying that. It was a National Book Award winner and a Pulitzer Prize finalist. And so the bar is really high to join One World, right?
Right.
It's a big deal, isn't it, Valerie,
to
be an author with Chris Jackson? It's a big effing deal. And you not only fit in there, but you're heroic in your offering, Valerie. I mean, I wrote to, speaking of Margaret Riley King, who you mentioned, your agent, and I would love to hear how you connected with Margaret, because talk about superheroes, which by definition possess abilities beyond those of ordinary people, and they use those powers to defeat evil and help the world become a better place. So by my lights, you are the perfect addition to her roster that includes Glennon Doyle and Sue Monk Kidd. I emailed her last night and I was like, there are no words to tell you how much I love Valerie's book. There just are no words. So yes, Margaret, how did you meet? She found you at a speech, right?
She did. Oh, it's so fascinating. I had spent all of my adult life since September 11th, since I first became a civil rights activist, just going from community to community, cause to cause. So I'd be working on solitary confinement one year and then racial profiling the next and then hate violence the next and mass incarceration the next and drawing connections between them all. And the more I labored with the communities, I was writing the stories, right? And I just thought I would live my entire life that way.
Oh, God.
A movement lawyer, right? An activist, you just labor and you follow where the need is. And then before this president was elected, when hate violence began to skyrocket, I was already experiencing that crisis because now hate violence was just as high as it was in the aftermath of 9/11 when I had first become an activist. So at that point, I was a fellow at Stanford Law School. I was working on net neutrality. That was my latest issue, thinking about digital freedom as a civil and human right. And I just couldn't do it anymore. I just had to stop and start to think about how to actually sustain and create change. And so I left my job and you know, it's amazing. Just a week later, I got a call from Jennifer Rudolph Walsh saying that she had worked with Glennon Doyle and they were working on a tour called the Together Tour. And would I be part of it? And suddenly I went from doing legal and policy work to like, all right, I will take my voice on the road with these extraordinary women. And Margaret was in the audience and found me after I'd given a speech and said, I believe in you. Mm. And she's the one from the start, actually, as soon as she saw my proposal, she said Chris Jackson's name.
Oh, that's awesome. You know, when you were just talking about being burnt out and quitting, it reminds me of what Van Jones talked about here, about how he was working on police misconduct and juvenile violence and youth organizing in the Bay Area for about a decade, and said there were only so many funerals and coalition meetings and bad outcomes on votes that he could handle before he burned out. Oh, by the way, can we just say that Van called your book a miracle, a blessing, a new paradigm, a renewal, something beautiful and true. How great is Van?
Oh. All true.
Van started, he called for a love army when this president took power.
Right. That's why I had him on. In fact, we had Glennon with him because Glennon was doing Love Warrior and Van was doing Love Army. And I was like, you two are two sides of the same coin, the love coin.
Yeah, we're all speaking into this call through our own voices and our own platforms and igniting our own audiences and the darkness of the tomb and the darkness of the room. That's what makes me lean into that. And I just want to go back to something that you named about One World.
Yes.
Linda, because I remember in the beginning, those first meetings with you, Chris, I just felt like I had imposter syndrome. I need to be worthy of.
Oh my God.
They're like, can I do this? And I'm ashamed to say that it lasted like a really long time. Anytime I missed a deadline or it didn't feel like the pages I sent over to Chris were, you know, was it worthy of him? And he never gave me any reason to feel that way. And instead, almost like every turn, Chris was holding up a mirror to superpowers that I couldn't see.
Yeah.
And there was a line from an old Bollywood film that keeps coming back to me. And it's this line, when my faith falters, I will have faith in your faith in me. I think that's what our relationship has been like.
Was there any particular time that you remember where your faith was failing and Chris just instantly turned it around?
Oh, it was like the whole time. So I talked about going away to the rainforest and to read my life, to read movements, to read theory, to read and to start to consolidate. And I was writing and I was writing and writing and writing. I wrote endlessly. I wrote for a year. And I knew that none of it was the book. It's almost like I had to write around everything in order to find it. And then I got pregnant. I was with, I had a young son, but then I became pregnant with a daughter. And I said, oh, I can do this. But then I got incredibly ill.
Sick. That's always fun.
So sick. I had high
deadline pressure. While throwing up.
Yeah, I threw up literally once every hour. I was out of the ER and I thought, and that was a moment where like, it's not going to happen. The book is not going to happen. And the hyperemesis lifted. I was in a wheelchair for the remainder of the pregnancy, but I could still sit up and write. And I remember thinking, it's now or never. And I don't think I was actually at risk in that pregnancy, but I felt like I might not make it. Like I felt like I was dying.
You know what's interesting about that? I hate to interrupt you, but I'm thinking, you know, at the start of See No Stranger, you say this book is for anyone who feels breathless. And hello, the timing is ridiculous. Obviously, you wrote this pre-George Floyd. Certainly, I Can't Breathe was an all too common refrain already. But sister, the timing. So I think it was urgent. I think this book had to come out right now. I think it was meant to come out right now. And doesn't it often feel like death when we're at that level of creation? I mean, that's so common to feel like we just cannot do it.
Yes. And for me, I kept thinking, if I don't make it, what do I need my daughter to know?
Oh, God.
And that's how the book finally came out of me. And I did it by speaking it out loud. My best friend was like, well, you're not finding your writing voice on the page. When do you sound like yourself? And I said, when I'm giving a speech.
Yeah.
when I see the audience in front of me, the ego in me gets really quiet. I stop trying to pretend to be perfect. And I just give them exactly what I need to give them from my heart to theirs. And so I began actually writing the chapters that you read as the long speech. And I said it out loud. And I would record myself and listen to it again. It was like more like composing music. Mm-hmm. Writing, there was a rhythm and cadence. And I realized now I felt so guilty. I wasn't talking to my daughter in my womb. Like I talked to my son, but she was being bathed with all the stories of my life and all the words and wisdom of my life. And Linda, do you know, I sat down at my writing desk to write the last words of this book. It was the letter I wanted to give her about living her life in joy. I'll just read them to you now.
Please.
It's in the epilogue. And I write to her, you are beloved just as you are. You are worthy of this earth and its seas and skies and the gifts it has to offer, just as you are. And the earth will receive all the gifts you give it, as long as the gifts that you give are given in joy. Let joy in every day, my love, let joy be your lifeblood. I read that last line out loud. I stood up. It was still very hard. I was still in a wheelchair, but I tried to stand up. And I immediately went into active labor, and my daughter was born 4 hours later.
That is nuts.
I delivered the book and the baby at the same time.
That is nuts. Oh my God. I can't even. Yeah. Okay, so Chris, how does it feel for you to help people's dreams come true like this?
How does it feel for me? Well,
to be a midwife, you're a midwife.
Clues you in a little bit. It is also, I'm helping them realize their worst nightmare, which is having to actually write the book. So it's an interesting journey that you take with writers, because I think at the beginning there is this kind of excitement, and then it's really, really hard work.
It's arduous.
It's the hardest work in some ways, because if you're going to write something that's true, you know, write something that's real, write something that's going to actually help people, you have to dig so deep, and you think you've gone deep enough, and then you have to go that extra layer deeper. When Valerie talks about having to go through the fire, and in some ways I think writing a book is like that, you know? Or, of course, this is not something I've experienced myself, but certainly I've read a lot about it, certainly in Valerie's book, and in Valerie's drafts even, about childbirth. It's hard. It's hard. And you do have these moments when you're like, I don't know, is this going to happen? Am I going to make it? And I think every writer goes through that. So in part, even when I'm making a deal with a writer,
yeah,
I know that we're going to go through a dark moment together at some point. Moments of doubt and moments of difficulty and moments when you have to think, I know my story. And then it turns out you don't know your story, that your story is maybe something deeper and maybe even more painful. And the story you've been telling yourself is your story. And it takes so much bravery, which is why I have so much admiration for the writers to really do that work, because it's a gift to give to readers and to the world. And it takes something really courageous in the writer to extract that gift. Yeah, so that's tricky. But on the other end, it's an absolute joy to be able to work with people from the genesis to their idea and help them shape it into a book that you know is going to help people. I sometimes am just looking through social media and I'm seeing the people who've been reading various books that I've worked on, but Valerie's book in particular right now. And you can just see like these little flashes of light from all over of people who've been touched or awakened or sustained by the book. And that is, for me, very rewarding, because that's what a publisher does, is get these sort of geniuses and get them out to be the bridge between the genius and the reader. And that's very rewarding.
Oh, that's beautiful. When Cheryl Strayed was on the show, she was talking about how she had just been thinking that when she wrote in Tiny Beautiful Things in the column, write like a motherfucker. She said, I was basically saying, you know, writing is hard, but coal mining is harder. And then she said, and then yesterday I realized, nope, I was wrong about that. Yeah, it's a bitch, right? And that blank page can be a real a-hole. So Chris, I want to ask you, what was your parents' dream for you?
I grew up in a very religious family. So their dreams for me all involved following my religious path.
Yeah.
Which I did not precisely follow. Although in some ways, I think a lot of what they wanted from me, I'm doing in other ways.
Yeah.
Which is they wanted me to be someone who was involved in evangelizing in the name of this particular religion. But what I'm doing now, I think, is my own version of that. But it's not precisely the dream they had for me.
I remember in that one of those first meetings, Chris, that you said something I'll never forget. You said, at One World, we try to practice what our authors are writing about. We try to bring their ideas into our lives.
Nice.
Into how we meet, into how we labor, into how we are. And I was so floored by that. And in the course of writing this book, and I was thinking about when I talk about the America that is longing to be born, we have to imagine it into being before we are able to live into it.
Sure.
And I keep thinking that One World is the one place that is solely devoted into creating a community of people who are presaging the world to come. Mm-hmm. And so I know that you're like, I didn't follow my parents' dream for me, but it is sacred work. It is prophetic work. It is necessary and life-giving work, not just for us as your authors, but for the country, for really the world right now.
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh, thank you.
Valerie, you talk about something I have not heard very many authors talk about in public, although in private, we often discuss this. And this is the idea of the postpartum blues that come after you release a book. Can you speak to that a little bit?
I didn't know it was coming.
Because we don't talk about it.
No, there's a story that you tell yourself. I think even when you're pregnant with an actual baby that, oh, the pregnancy is hard. The laboring is hard. And then the delivery and the baby will come and the book will come and it will all be easy. And in a way, you have to tell yourself that. Because the idea that there's more hardship on the other side is just right. Too much. And what I did experience, oh, now that I think about it, it was almost like, you know, when baby arrives in your chest, if you birth a certain way, then there's this rush of oxytocin and you are just shaking and sobbing and you're falling in love and you're in the moment.
Yep.
And you're just relieved and grateful. And honestly, that happened for about 7 days after this book was published. And the book is only 6 weeks old at the time of this conversation. So for the first week, I felt that amazing relief and release. And then it was like, who am I now?
Yep. Yeah, because if you've been carrying something, hello, you were in gestation for 18 years. So you didn't even know yourself as somebody who had written a book. You had no vision of yourself as that person.
That's right. They say that every birth is a rebirth for a mother.
Oh.
I certainly feel that way now. I am still finding what it feels like to be in my skin and in my mind, in my body, and move through this world with this book on the outside of me.
Yeah.
And initially, I have to say, I felt lost. I felt sorrow. I felt grief. It was all so odd.
Yeah.
I felt worried like a mother. Like, is it finding its way in the world? Will it live its purpose? How much do I show up? How much do I let it, you know? All of those things. And I feel like I'm just now discovering that often what the book needs, you know, the book needs a lot of attention and a lot of,
yes,
there's a lot of, it's charged, it's out there in the world. It's not the same as what the mother needs. And you never tell a mother after she's given a birth, so when will the next baby be? All I need is rest. I need to just who I am now and what new music is rising in me and what I'm now called to do and be and how to mother this book and also just let myself be the next version of who I am in the world. So I'm in the thick of that process.
I think there's a really interesting balance between putting your work out in the world and being visible and being available and also receiving. Energetically, there's so much to the process of receiving the gift of. So I think part of what you're doing here right now is you're letting me love on you and you're letting Chris love on you and you're going to let our listeners love on you. And that isn't always easy. It's an effort and it's a labor to be seen and to receive that love that we're giving you. And it's a balance. It's a process. And everybody has to get comfortable in their own way. And there is no right way to do this. But I've been watching you. I've been watching your lives and your interviews. And you're just doing an elegant and beautiful job. So just keep doing it.
I so appreciate that. There was a point in writing this book. It was chapter 4 when, you know, the book is organized in these 10 core paths of revolutionary love. And one of them is rage. And I knew that I wanted to tell the stories that showed people how I learned about rage as a part of love. And as I was writing and constructing the chapter, I realized that in order to tell the whole truth, I had to talk about things that I was not planning to talk about. I had to write about sexual violence and police brutality and the chronic illness and pain that those assaults have caused in my body and my struggles around them. And truly, I went to my husband, who is more private than I am, and I was telling him, well, in order to talk about rage, I have to say X, Y, Z. And I was waiting for him to draw a bright line.
Yeah. Me,
you know, to please just say like
please don't.
These things, but not that. I was waiting for him. And he said, tell the truth, tell the truth, tell the truth. He said, don't censor yourself now. Pretend like no one's going to read it. Just tell the truth. And then after it is on the page, then we'll sit with each other and we'll decide what goes in and what stays out.
Yeah. I actually have a couple of questions related to some of the pain. The first thing that really, really hit me in your story, Valerie, you're in school in California. Your best friends believed you were going to go to hell. And they tell you this one day because you're not a Christian. And you write that despite how close you had been, they could not love you as before. And my son, also in California, was told by his seventh grade teacher that his beloved aunt, my sister, was going to hell because she was a Vedic astrologer, because her gift to the world came via the spiritual texts of the Hindus. So in that moment, my son lost his love for the teacher, lost his love for the school and for school in general for a time. So never mind, Valerie, that your family had been contributing to America, feeding Americans via your farm for nearly 100 years. Never mind that my son's aunt had counseled and helped thousands of people through her work. Seeing someone as other and illegitimate in the eyes of God is common. It's easy. But what is not easy is seeing those same people who judge us as worthy of love. And you are so brilliant the way you talk about in this book about how to come from a place of love in the face of judgment or worse, outright abuse. Can you speak to that?
I learned it the long and hard way that as long as I let them make me hate them, they had power over me.
Wow.
And if I could see that, and you know, in the book, I sit with white supremacists and prison guards and soldiers and my own former abusers. And I had spent so long thinking of them as monsters. And as long as I saw them as monsters, they had absolute psychological power over me.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime I found myself safe enough or brave enough to sit and try to understand them, then beneath the slogans or the sound bites, I could begin to see their story and feel their pain and see the wound in them.
Yeah.
And so I discover like, oh, there are no such thing as monsters in this world. There are only human beings who are wounded, who are doing what they're doing out of their own sense of insecurity or anxiety or blindness or greed. Even my best friends, when I was a kid, they had inherited a theology that divided the world into us and them,
right,
that severed them off from their own inner longing to want to love me. And yeah. So in a way, we were both suffering. Our suffering was not equivalent, but I could see how tormented they were and had been. And that is the practice of love, that mm-hmm. it preserves their humanity and our own.
Yeah.
But I do need to say this because I feel like it's so important to say in this time that if you are someone right now who has a knee on your neck, like so many Black and Brown people do right now, it is not necessarily your role to look up at your oppressor and try to wonder about them.
Amen.
Or listen to them, or even yeah. try to listen. Like, your job is to stay alive. Your job is to take the next breath. Your job is to love yourself and your own flesh well enough to make it to last. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think about revolutionary love as a practice that happens in community, because there might be others by virtue of their skin or whatever privilege they might have who can do that work, who can do that labor right now. Mm-hmm. I think about all of the white folks right now forming a wall in front of Black
people
on the street.
I love it.
An army of police officers. We've never seen that before. We've
never
had many willing to be accomplices. So what does it mean for them to do the work of bringing along all the disaffected white people who will still be around the day after the election so that we can begin to transition?
Your physical courage is pretty staggering. You've been arrested. You've been injured by police. The list is long between your sexual abuse and facing your accuser. And the healing story about that in your book is astonishingly beautiful for all parties involved. But you've been to Guantanamo. You've worked for police reform and been followed. Your family's been followed. You've stood up to those white supremacists you just mentioned, like that scene in the restaurant. I won't give it away, but just talking with these guys about their bigotry in the restaurant is like, girlfriend, you are fucking amazeballs. How, what can you say to our listeners, our writers out there who are still scared to tell their stories?
Oh, well, first of all, when you sum it all up like that.
Jesus, holy mother. Like, who are you?
God, I keep thinking.
And how do we buy some of that? Can you bottle it? I mean, I guess it's in the book. It's in the book. I'm just going to keep listening to the book.
Well, what you're not hearing in that beautiful picture that you painted is all of the fear inside of me at each one of those moments. Ever since I was a kid and I got my first racial slurs or attempts to convert me as a kid, I feel like there's been a voice in me who I now call the little critic. So many of us, but especially women of color, people of color, have this voice inside of them, right? You are not smart enough. You are not good enough. You are not strong enough. You're not white enough. You're not American enough. You're not enough. And I feel like my life has been this story of this power struggle between the critic in me that wants to make me small. And the thing is, the critic is just trying to protect me because it is unsafe.
Of course.
As a woman of color to do all those things. And so the power struggle has been between that critic that wants to make me small and this wise woman in me, the warrior in me who says, oh, my love, you are brave enough. Mm. Audre Lorde says, we can learn how to mother ourselves. So breathe, my love, and push. Just show up one more time, one more day. And that's, I feel like my whole life has been the choice of listening to that voice and quieting the other.
Wow. Chris, how about you? Do you ever feel afraid publishing such visionary, cutting edge stuff?
No, I mean, I feel afraid sometimes for the writers. The writers have, generally speaking, been attacked in the press, in social media, by people who even they admired. And one of the things I think about when I'm editing books is wanting the writer to go as far as they can possibly go in terms of making their points as strongly and as clearly as possible. But also part of me does worry sometimes for them because I know that it's not a game when you're out there challenging sort of status quo ideas and when you're trying to put yourself on the side of the people who are being attacked. You know, as Valerie does throughout the book, all those instances you mentioned, those are forces of power in this country.
No shit.
She was not attacked by, you know, random people necessarily. She was attacked from the forces of state,
systems,
the forces of patriarchy, these larger forces. And those forces don't go away because you wrote a book that calls them out
and
tries to provide tools for people who want to reorient society away from them. And it's dangerous work. And I've seen, certainly in the case of some writers, it goes as far as death threats and all of that. For other writers, it's just constant attack, you know, verbal attack and criticism that goes beyond simple criticism. People trying to silence them, get them to shut up, get them to go away because their voices are too disruptive to status quo and to power as it exists. So I do worry about the writers. I don't worry about myself because luckily I'm deep behind the scenes, which sometimes makes me feel a little bit guilty because I get to kind of hide in my office somewhere while their names are on the book. They're the ones who are out there in the world. But I do worry about them because I don't think this is a game.
Yeah. No, I understand. For years, I have interviewed people on the front lines, and I started my career interviewing green heroes on the front lines of climate change and doing crazy things. I remember, 25 years ago, Keely Shea and Pierce Brosnan showed me video that a friend of theirs had taken. It was a hidden camera that he had snuck onto a fishing vessel, and it showed the practice of tuna fishermen encircling and killing, massacring hundreds of dolphins. It was the most horrific video I've ever seen. It was just, the ocean was blood red. And it was so torturous watching the mother dolphins being stripped from the babies. And it was an illegal tuna, or actually, I think it was legal at the time. It was a tuna vessel. And so Keely and Pierce took that film footage, and it's part of how they got Congress to enact the Dolphin Safe Tuna Act. And so throughout my career, I've always interviewed people on the front lines, Jane Goodall and my heroes. And I've often thought, God, Linda, you should be out there with them. But there's a place for the people who are telling the stories as well. We can't all be down there in the blood and the guts. And sometimes we are. Sometimes I march, and sometimes I'm out there screaming too. But I'm comfortable telling the stories of the storytellers as well. So I think there's a place for all of us.
Absolutely.
No one gives birth alone. And the role of the midwives is perhaps just as essential as the body that is doing the creating.
Wow.
So you both, and certainly I've experienced this with Chris at my side, are the midwives of this time when we so need it.
Okay, now you're going to make me cry. that's a gift. Thank you for saying that. Valerie, we were just mentioning systems, and your work reforming police departments is so staggering. In East Haven, I'll just give a little backstory. It's a small industrial town in New England, home to a growing Latinx population. And you write about how police officers were stopping and detaining residents without reason, sometimes beating or tasering them. Shopkeepers watched officers waiting to harass customers outside their stores. Families were afraid to walk or drive through parts of town. People were terrified. And when asked whether they would tell their stories, they said no, because it was just too dangerous, until this first year little law student at Yale showed up, you and your friend. Talk about how you helped remake the department and how this has gone way beyond that area, way beyond East Haven.
Oh, we became a coalition that night in the church basement. The priest had put up a big piece of paper, and he drew a straight line down the middle and said, who has the power in this town? And the people said, the police, the mayor, and they literally had just shown us scars on their wrists from the hands of these police officers. And then he says, well, who else has the power in this town? And finally, somebody said, Dios. And the priest says, that's right. The people with God in their hearts have the power. And he wrote down, this is the world as it is, and this is the world as it ought to be, and let's live into the world as it ought to be. And when people were too afraid, yes, all eyes went to the corner of the room. So first year, and I swallowed, and suddenly we became, he's like, don't worry, we have our lawyers in the room. And we became a coalition. And I enlisted the resources of the legal clinic at my law school. And we became a coalition of law students and lawyers and faith leaders and community leaders. And over the next 3 years, we launched a multi-pronged campaign, just getting the Department of Justice to investigate. And it all led to a monumental consent decree where we had the four police officers who were most responsible for the brutality were arrested and put behind bars.
That is so amazing.
So amazing. One of them had trailed me on my way home from school. It was terrifying. And arrested on charges of conspiracy, false arrest, excessive force, obstruction of justice. But we knew that it was never just about a few bad actors. And this is where the practice of love is so effective. Because if we think about them as human beings who are being radicalized and authorized by an institution, then the real bad guy is the police department itself and changing the culture of the department. So we sat in that basement of that church and had the people themselves imagine what a just police department would look like in their town. And they came up with 7 demands. We got 6 of them in the consent decree, and the 7th on a lawsuit that we filed afterwards. So yes, we had, over the course of those years, not only ended the reign of terror by this police department, we had reimagined the department. And then it's now been used as a model in Ferguson and Baltimore. And certainly I'm guessing Minneapolis is looking into it as they're imagining what their public safety system might look like. But I have to share with you this moment that I'll never forget from that campaign. It was the night before our very first press release. And we'd stayed up all night working with our people on their stories. And they were going to break their silence for the first time. And we sat in the church pews in the morning. And I was so nervous. And then the priest says, first, we have to pray. And as a kid, remember, I had always seen the cross as a sign of my damnation. I was always uncomfortable in churches. Yeah. And I would pray. I held my breath. And suddenly, everyone began to break into a song in Spanish, I'm reading now, a song of liberation and longing that seemed to flow down to us through the centuries like a river, sweeping us up in the current. My heart soared and my eyes welled up with tears. We were no longer leading. We were being carried forth from the dark night in the basement church into the light of day. Mm. Vincent Harding talks about this revolutionary river, you know, that has taken the blood and the sweat of all the people who have lived and fought and died for justice. And I hold on to that moment because in my darkest moments, I just need to close my eyes and hear that song and feel the roar of the river and let that carry me.
Oh my God.
It's beautiful.
You know, in 2005, I co-authored a book for cops, and it was a mental and emotional guide for law enforcement professionals. And I wrote it with a blind cop. I was his eyes. Dr. Bobby Smith, he had been shot in the face at a highway drug checkpoint. And as a result, he had lost everything, his job, his home, his wife. Then his daughter was killed in a car accident. And Bobby died of a heart attack a few years ago. But by the time we'd met, he had become the most beloved law enforcement speaker in the world. He was a leader, a moral compass for cops. Because after his shooting, he had gone back to school, he got his PhD, he became a trauma therapist for officers who have some of the highest rates of divorce and addiction and suicide. And I have been so sad lately that I couldn't call Bobby and say, dude, what the hell? What do you think? What is happening here? And I just picked up our book before our call, and I haven't looked at it in years, and I said a little prayer to Bobby. And I really miss him. And I said, Bobby, what do you want me to say right now? And I closed my eyes and I opened from the middle of the book. And here's where my fingers landed, which to me was sort of astonishing because I don't even remember transcribing this part, but it was on page 164, where Dr. Bobby Smith asked cops to take a pledge, which I would like to read here. It's short. He says, I, officer, fill in the blank, commit today to be the best person I can be to myself, to my family, and the people I protect and serve and work with. I commit to getting and staying healthy, both emotionally and physically. I commit to release my emotions in a positive way through healthy outlets and to get help somehow, some way when I need it. I understand that I can't do it alone and that I need to reach out to the people I love and who love me every day. And then Bobby writes, while you imagine your best self, aspire to be that person. I'm not talking about being a saint. I'm talking about being a real and honest and true blue officer and human being who does their emotional work and treats people cleanly and fairly. And you know, even though Bobby and I talked every day while writing his book, I cannot say what wisdom he would share now about reforming our policing systems, although I have no doubt he'd have plenty to say. But he ends that section of the book with this line to his fellow officers, which makes me miss him all the more. Dare to dream big here because only you determine the outcome of your humanity.
Hmm.
Anyway.
Wow.
Thanks for listening. I think about him a lot. I imagine, Val, that there is great fear within the police forces of this country right now. And I imagine that the officers who stayed with the New Haven department that you helped restructure were grateful for the changes that resulted. And that transformation had to have made going to work a better and safer and more joyful experience for them. Did you receive any of that kind of feedback?
I haven't been in touch with them, but I do know that since George Floyd's murder, they have been issuing statements of solidarity and walking alongside Black Lives Matter protesters in the streets of East Haven.
Wow. Your speech at the A&E Church and your standing ovation at TED, I'm guessing there were a lot of steps from idea to done before you ever got those standing ovations. And I'm guessing part of that trajectory for you was going from fear to courage on the stage. Is that accurate?
I think it's mostly about just quieting that voice of the little critic and bringing to my mind's eye the people for whom I'm there for, whose stories would otherwise not be told, whose pain goes unseen in this country. And once I decenter myself that way, and then I can fully inhabit the thing that I most need people to hear. And when I'm on a stage like that, oh, it is just like writing the book, right? It's like,
yeah.
I have to feel the grief in my body. And then it's almost like my voice then follows the feeling in my body and the images that I see. If I can see it, if I can be on the street corner with the blood still fresh on the ground, if I can be on the shores of Guantanamo looking into the eyes of the detainee, if I can be with my son on Christmas Eve as he's putting the milk and cookies by the fireplace and waking up the next morning and my heartbreak and my tears in the wake of another hate crime, I have to go back to those places and I have to see those things and I have to feel that pain. And then it's like my voice follows. And if I feel it and if I see it, then I know that you feel it and you see it. And I learned very quickly that that was the only way to make people care.
That's a good point.
For me, the Sikh community has been so invisible in this country. So after Balbir Singh Sodhi's murder, he was the first person killed in a hate crime after 9/11. He was someone I called uncle. I could stand on a stage and I could tell you that there are 23 million Sikhs worldwide and 500,000 in the United States, and we believe in one God and equality and social justice. And you would nod politely, but feel nothing. And the next time you saw a turban, your body would still react as like, oh, terrorist, right? I learned very quickly as a matter of survival that if I were to make other people who did not know us love us, then I had to invite you to see us differently. You had to see him as uncle. You had to see me as sister or daughter. And so my life has been telling stories in this way. And I realized, like, even this book, remember, Chris, we're like, gosh, the framework for revolutionary love is so strong. It could just be an ideas book, but the stories are so strong. It could just be a memoir. And right. into saying, no, let's make this into something new. Let it be a synthesis. Let it be a memoir and a manifesto. And in a way, you know, I could tell you about revolutionary love, but if I could give you an experience of it, which required me to go into my own trauma and grief and rage and joy, if I can put that on the page, then perhaps it would be an experience that did its work on you so that you could emerge on the other side, feeling your own self differently, seeing differently.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Moving through the world differently.
Yeah, it's so poetic. Your writing is so stunning and it's so visual. It's very cinematic. It's obvious that you're a filmmaker. And I did feel like you pulled me into your story. Our stories were so different, but I felt like I was you as I was reading it.
Thank you.
I want to talk about college for a minute and getting one's degree. Valerie, you've earned degrees at Stanford. My mom worked at Stanford for 22 years. I love Stanford so much.
Oh, wow.
Oh my God. Oh my God. And then you got a degree from Harvard Divinity School and Yale Law School. I left USC just shy of getting my degree. And Chris, I believe, didn't you leave Columbia just shy of getting yours?
I did.
So in between The World and Me, Ta-Nehisi Coates writes, I was made for the library, not the classroom. The classroom was a jail of other people's interests. The library was open, unending, free. But without going to USC, I don't think I would have spent so much damn time in the library. Doheny Library became my mecca. And universities often have the most incredible libraries. So I would love to hear from both of you on college, no college. Is it important for your writing? Thoughts in general?
I would say that yes, one of the things I love about Between the World and Me is that he writes about both what's essential about that experience and then what feels restrictive about the experience of college. Yeah. Now, my experience was much different than Ta-Nehisi's. I actually loved the classroom, but had other things I had to do outside of school that kind of drew me out of it. But I loved the classroom. I loved it. I also loved the library. And that goes back all the way to my earliest childhood experiences, where the library was the place where I got stuck. While my mother had to do errands or had to work or had to do whatever she had to do, I was stuck in the library, and I loved the sense of it being this inextinguishable resource of stories and ideas that I didn't have contact or access to otherwise.
Nice.
But I do think that we all have to find our college in a way. And sometimes that happens in the walls of a university, and sometimes it happens in life. But the place where I think something in us is ignited, some central core curiosity that we have to pursue. And I think it can happen in lots of different environments. And I think sometimes academic environments can be hostile to that. I love when Valerie writes in her book about going to law school and thinking of it as a place where she was learning spells, you know, that it was a different language, but it was a language that was important to know because it was a language that could have an effect in the real world. As arcane as it may be, and as abstract or alien as it may seem, it was as alien as learning a spell that could unlock a door, which is what her legal degree actually did in very literal ways. You have to figure out what is the purpose you're going to make of this education. And I think Valerie in her book, it's so good in showing that education can be this sort of purposeful thing. And then there are other moments when it's just an experience of exposure and of unexpected serendipitous connection. So I think it has lots of different values, but I think there are things that can happen in and out of the classroom that can also serve that function. Another beautiful thing about Valerie's book is it's really about a series of educations that she gets. And some of those happen in academic settings. Some of those happen on the streets. Some of those happen in the most intimate parts of her life, in those relationships that she's in. But that it's all this kind of different streams of education and different layers of education that happen and continue to happen both in and out of the classroom throughout her life.
Leave it to an editor to summarize it perfectly.
That's what I was thinking.
Oh my God. Okay, Valerie, you have to talk about the Harry Potter. You're Harry, didn't you say something like the heroes in Harry Potter, they were students.
Right. They were young and they wielded a kind of magic when the adults and the grown-ups in their world wouldn't or
right.
Yeah, that's it. You know, I think about that time in college listening to you both reflect and realize that I think my single most important educational moment in college was in the streets, protesting the
Iraq
war and getting arrested for the first time. And the friendships I built with this circle of women who I call the pocket, who I'm still like, we're still the pocket every year since college. We still come together to make each other brave. And I remember I was graduating from college and a professor called me into her office and said, I don't say this very often, but you have to go to law school. And I said, no. It was the last thing on my mind. And she said, look, you're a woman of color. I see you. You have an activist heart. You're going to keep ending up out there. And if you want people to listen to you, then you have to get your degrees. And I realized like she was talking about degrees as if they were armor. You don't go into battle without a sword and a shield, without armor. And so, yes, I'm a daughter of farmers who the first books we had in our house were the ones I brought home from the library. It was such a new world I was entering. And now suddenly this wiser woman in my life was saying, no, you go to Stanford, you go to Harvard, you go to Yale to be able to fight the good fight in the world and to be safe. And even then, how safe is it? But as safe as you can possibly be.
Yeah.
So yes, like thinking about it as spells, as magic, or as protection out in the world. But I feel like I was very, very lucky to be able to find a life where my education could involve these institutions. And so when I talk about the rainforest, I brought my journals, but I also brought the books that had most influenced me at each of those institutions.
Oh, nice.
And so you'll see, that's why the book is like, that's why See No Stranger is a personal memoir. It's a manifesto. And it's like the end notes are so thick. Remember?
I know they are like so thick.
They're so thick. It adds so much bulk to the book because so well researched. It's like, it's like my entire life. That's what it felt like.
So funny. Chris, this may be putting you on the spot a little bit, but okay. I am a tree hugger. I'm a tree hugger whose art kills trees. No conflict there, right? So I want to address that a little bit about sustainability in our industry. My last book was with Simon & Schuster. It was printed on 100% post-consumer waste and soy inks. I had to walk. They weren't willing to do it, but God, it was an environmental book, so I had to put my foot down. But there are alternatives now. There's FSC certified paper. And do you think about the fact that 30 million trees are felled a year to publish books? And are you thinking about that when you're publishing and working towards being more sustainable?
That's an interesting question. And it is putting me on the spot. But we're working on right now, the book is coming out in about a month or two by two women environmental activists and scientists, Kathleen Wilkinson and Ayanna Johnson. In fact, one of the things that was like a contractual requirement when we were doing, because they wanted us to figure out the most environmentally sustainable way to print the book.
Yeah.
Which led to some interesting conversations with our production and manufacturing people. It's something that the company as a whole is trying to move toward at Random House.
Sure.
Trying to move toward more sustainable ways of printing the books. But I think it's also an interesting project for us to try to think about, well, what is the next level of sustainability? And for an industry that is, as you said, still is a paper-based industry, even though there are all these other forms. And of course, there's environmental questions about every form that the books take.
Exactly.
If they're digital, if they're audio, what are the consequences of that? So that's something that we are really starting to look into, because I think that's absolutely right. Even when you're doing books that you think are adding somehow, you know, are part of, are virtuous in a way, or at least are opening up people to ideas that are important. Like, you don't want to also, while you're doing it, destroy the earth, which would be sort of counterproductive to the larger mission.
And that's how I've always looked at it. I went into this industry knowing that it was a conflict, but also knowing that I needed to be gentle with myself and everybody else, because we're walking into systems. And systems don't change overnight. They're big, grinding, massive entities. And so I've just done my best over the years to plant trees or to offset my habits in any way that I could, and to educate, and then to hope, like you just said, to hope that the books that I was a part of were adding such value that there was some worthiness in doing it that way, and always hoping that there would be better practices to come. And so I'm just starting to ask people that question and talk about, well, what are we doing and what can we do and how can we offset things? And it's just something to start thinking about.
It's a really important question, because we have so many things that we're fighting, so many different issues that we're trying to address. I think the issue of climate change and the issue of environmental sustainability is in some ways the issue ultimately for us as a species. What's interesting is almost everything that we work on, though, whether it's police reform or whatever the individual issues are that we're working on, part of what's happening in terms of changing of consciousness, I think, gets us closer to a point where we're able to address the biggest problems we have more successfully. I have this book out right now, How to Be an Anti-Racist by Kendi. And it's a great book. And it's about literally how to work your way through these ideas of hierarchies of human value and how to free yourself from them. But you start to see all of the connections between anti-racist thinking and thinking that allows us all to work together on common projects to save ourselves as a species. And as long as you have racist ideas that are sort of organizing us, you're not going to get to a point where you can make those kinds of changes, because you start to say, well, it's affecting them, it's not affecting me, therefore it doesn't matter.
Right.
And all of these ideas are hopefully bringing us closer to a world where we can actually take collective action to save ourselves. So I think that's important. So I wouldn't want to stop the dissemination of those ideas. But at the same time, you have to think about these things holistically and how you're able to, in the product itself, represent the ideas. That's a challenge for us as an industry.
Yeah. Well, it's a good conversation to have. And thank you for going there with me. And I'll let you know what I learn. I'm learning a lot of stuff about that. And I'll stay in touch with you. I have some ideas.
That's amazing.
I enjoyed
listening and learning. The conversation that you are all having, I feel like I'm hearing that kind of version of conversation happening in so many different kinds of industries and spaces, certainly around racial justice, but then it connects to everything else. And so this shift from, there's a chapter in the book called Reimagine. And
yes,
Chris, I almost feel like when I wrote it, I thought it was so radical. But I feel like now everybody is shifting
so true.
From resistance to reimagining the institutions that order the world. So
yeah, this is beautiful. All right, I want to end with Papaji. Papaji, your grandfather, Valerie, you write that he was so wondrous to you, as infinite and inexhaustible as the night sky, and he had worlds of stories in him, ancient stories, that he would bequeath to you in slivers, and stories of gurus and saints and warriors and poets and soldiers and farmers, and that these stories formed a long and shimmering history that spanned centuries from India to America and ended with you. And I will say thank you, because nothing has ended with you. Everything is continuing with you. And you and Chris and your alliance is such a model for us in publishing about how to get this right. And I just thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate it.
Total joy.
This was so beautiful. I so enjoyed this time. Thank you, Linda.
Yes, me too. Thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure. All right. Love. Revolutionary love, people.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Valerie. I have missed recording this show so much, and what a love fest to return to. To find out more about Chris Jackson, his superhero authors, and to order Valerie, See No Stranger, go to oneworldlit.com. All things Valerie Kaur and Revolutionary Love Project can be found at valeriekaur.com. That's K-A-U-R. There you will find details on what it means to rise up in revolutionary love, starting with the Declaration of Love for All in Harm's Way, including refugees, immigrants, Muslims, Sikh, Jews, queer and trans people, Black people, Asian Americans, Latinx people, the indigenous, the disabled, women and girls, working class people, and poor people. There's a Declaration of Love even for opponents. It's the policies that threaten the rights and dignity of any person that they fight, and not with violence or vitriol, but by challenging the cultures and institutions that promote hate. And lastly, you'll see a declaration to love oneself and protect one's capacity for joy in honoring one's ancestors whose bodies, breath, and blood call one to a life of courage. In their name, the darkness becomes not as the darkness of the tomb, but of the womb. The call is to breathe and push through the pain of this era to birth a new future. Let us know how this episode landed for you. We would love to hear your comments over on iTunes or wherever you listen to us. Your 5 stars and love notes make it easier for other people to find us, and it's so appreciated. For those of you who have reached out to me wondering when the heck I'm going to be leading Carmel writing retreats again, I don't know. I miss them so much, but I gotta keep everyone safe. To find out about my virtual retreats or book proposal support, go to bookmama.com or beautifulwriterspodcast.com. Huge thanks to Kevin Baker, my sound engineer over at Red Room Sound, and Julia McPherson at Inner Space Marketing for our beautiful images. To close out the show today, a big thank you to Annie DeFranco and Righteous Babe Records for allowing us to use a song they produced for this book and the revolutionary love movement coming this fall. It's aptly called See No Stranger. Until next time, right on.
See no stranger, let's break this thing open. And distance is danger, so I'll pull you close in.
See no monster, we all come here broken. But love can unbreak us if it goes unspoken.
See no stranger, not saying I'm a savior. But I'm here to show you that open is braver.
See no monster, cause monsters are fiction. Real people are messy, and so is forgiveness.
The act of forgiveness is such tricky business. Let me hear your story, and I'll be your witness.
Let me be
be your sister, let me be your brother, let me see you now
with the eyes of a mother.
La 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 la.
Monster, just more learned behavior.
Under his thick skin is something so tender.
See no stranger, no typecast, no token.
See all people as people in motion.
There are no monsters, there are no strangers. That's just a shedding of arms.